From my good side, I don't have a good side. Okay.
All right. Well, welcome to the seventh edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This is a monthly class for current DMSC students and faculty and those interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. This allows us to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and those in healthcare who have made a difference. So a few housekeeping issues for those of you who are attending. Please keep your microphones on mute. Make comments in the chat section if you have any comments during the presentation. Once we're finished, we will open it up to questions and you can unmute yourself. Dr. Beth Popray, our administrative manager of the DMSC, will monitor the chat for any questions or comments. So, but let me take a minute to introduce our guest today. I've been looking forward to this. It's an honor for me to introduce Dave Mittman. Dave has been a PA leader for over 48 years. He founded the LIU PA Program Student Society back in 1973, was president of the New York State Society of PAs from 78 to 79, and served on the AAPA Board of Directors, actually twice, 35 years apart. Dave also has won the AAPA Public Education Award for leading the march in Trenton, New Jersey to establish PA practice many years ago. Dave was introduced to medicine as a medic in the United States Air Force. He later had the distinction of becoming the first PA allowed to practice in the Air Force Reserves. Dave spent almost 9 years in a primary care group practice in Brooklyn, New York, and left to begin a career in medical publishing with Physician Assistant Journal in late 1983. He left the PA Journal to co-found Clinicians Publishing Group in 1990 and Clinician Reviews Journal in 1991. This was the first journal written for both NPs and PAs. Dave and his partners took Clinicians Group and built it into a major publishing business, launching 8 journals in 6 different physician specialties within an 8-year period, something never done before in the history of medical publishing. In 2001, the Clinicians Group was acquired by Jobson Publishing. So Dave completed his term as president of the AAPA in 2020 after serving on the AAPA board for 5 years. Dave has also previously served on the AAPA board from 82 to 84. Dave was awarded an honorary doctorate in medical science in 2020 by the trustees of Lynchburg University in Lynchburg, Virginia. In 2008, Dave co-founded Clinician One, which is the largest NP and PA informational / clinical / social community on the web. Clinician One was acquired by a private firm and Clinician One ceased publication in late 2019. Dave's now involved with video Q&A feature on POCN and serves as a consultant for a number of corporations. He has also served as treasurer of the Association of Family Practice PAs and a co-founder of the American College of Clinicians and PAs, NPAs for Tomorrow, the first president for executive and administrative PAs. Dave has authored numerous papers and studies in publications as diverse as Chicken Soup for the Expectant Mother's Soul, U.S. Pharmacist, Medical Marketing and Media, and many others. He was the primary author of the first international paper on PAs published in the British Medical Journal. Dave is a noted expert in PA and NP practice, both in the U.S. and worldwide, and has published papers on both NP and PA prescribing. He has consulted for many companies on NP and PA practice and has spoken at numerous PA and NP meetings with audiences ranging from 5 to 8,000. Dave is also an adjunct faculty member in the doctorate program at Lynchburg University, specializing in PA advocacy. Dave's married to his high school sweetheart, Bonnie, for over 47 years now, and has 2 wonderful adult children and currently resides in Florida. So I could say more, but Dave, welcome to the masterclass.
Well, thank you very much. You know, Randy's an old friend. We met when we were both young and debonair. He's still debonair. And, you know, I'm really honored to be here. Whenever we can share information, I think it's a blessing for all of us because we learn from each other. And I don't think we do that enough. So I'm really honored to be here. So thanks.
Absolutely. Well, let's get right to it, Dade. So you started your career as a clinically practicing PA in the very early days of the profession. As Nard noted, you started off as a medic in the United States Air Force. So what drew you to the Air Force as a medic and then to the PA profession? And then also tell us a little bit about your early clinical practice and what it was like to be a new clinician in a really unknown profession.
Wow, a lot, many questions. So I went into the Air Force Reserves actually, and that how I got in would be an amazing story. Only can be done in New York, actually, and I won't tell you the story because it's too weird. It's really too weird. But I get in and. I trained and I did very well. And they said, okay, you're going to be an air evacuation specialist. So I said, what the heck's that? And they said, okay, you go fly in a plane and you pick up basically wounded non-Air Force people and from Scott Air Force Base to Andrews Air Force Base, and you fly them back and forth continually. And you'll get good at it and don't worry about it. And you'll have a lot of fun. And I did. And while I worked at Andrews, I didn't do a lot of family practice, obviously as a medic, you know, but I wasn't in a family practice clinic, but I was in the ER. And I met some young men who were amazing clinicians who, with my limited knowledge, I saw what, I didn't know the word for it then, but I do now, their outcomes were incredible. And I made friends with a couple and I said, you know, you're not physicians. By the way, we shouldn't use the term doctor for physician anymore. We should be aware of that, all of us. And I didn't say that. I said, you're not doctors at the time. And they said, no, we're PAs. And I said, tell me about it. And I was like, just amazed. I was pre-law at 3 years of college or 2.5. And I did have a minor in like biology. So I took a lot of the courses before and I got out. They said there are civilian schools, you know, go after you get out. I did 7 months and 6 days of active duty, got out, went right to the one PA school in my borough, Brooklyn. I'm a Brooklyn kid. And they said, you need 2 courses, speech and something else. Took those courses. Got right into the program, and the rest is history. What I really learned, well, a couple of things. My political awareness grew as a medic in the Air Force because the Air Force PAs were enlisted, and all the other PAs in the service were warrant officers. Air Force didn't have warrant officers, so already I'm a little, you know, I'm looking at everybody with a jaundiced eye, right? I'm like, what the heck's going on here? I mean, these guys are great. And I saw how good they were. So I'm like, we got to change this. And I learned a little politics. I learned a little medicine, but I learned that I liked medicine and I learned that I liked people. And I didn't know that before. I liked my friends. I liked people from Brooklyn, but I really didn't know that I liked mostly everybody. And I learned that in the Air Force and it was good. Got out and started making friends with the Air Force PAs who were active nationally, made best friends with Dave Gwynn, who I know Randy remembers well. And he and I devised a plan on how we're going to get PAs commissioned as officers. And that actually worked. The main person holding up commissioning was a Senator Joe. He was in, not a senator, he was a assembly. Not an assembly. He was in the Senate, not the Senate, the House. I'm sorry. So he was a representative. And his name was Joe Addavo. And he was from a district in Queens, New York. And I was still in the reserve. So I got 25 of people from my unit in uniform for all of us to visit him. And we visited him twice. And I was the only PA. I wasn't a PA in uniform. And we got him to eventually pass commissioning. He was the guy holding it up. And it was great. And I left the reserves after 10 years And I was the first unofficial PA in the Air Force Reserve, but I got the bug about being in advocacy, being a leader. All of that really came from the Air Force. And I was involved concurrently with NISPA, with New York State Society of PAs. I was president of NISPA when I was 26 years old. And it carried the weight when I went to see Senator Adaba or Representative Adaba. So that all worked. I think later it became a state senator, so I'm thinking of him as a senator, but it all worked fine. And, you know, he finally relented and we all got commissioned. So it was wonderful. You know, and it really led to so much more later on. And I loved the Air Force, and I loved being in it, and I loved getting out of it.
Well, you bring up a good point, Dave. I first actually met you when you were president of the New York State Society, I think in the late 70s. And from the very beginning, you were involved in the AAPA in its early days. And throughout your career, including being president of the AAPA just a few years ago. But tell us a little bit more about, you know, you went right into advocacy. You've always been in advocacy. What led you to step up to the plate in leadership in both your state and with the AAPA?
Well, first of all, I believe leadership can't be taught. I think you can model leadership, but I think some of us are born as leaders and some of us are born as kind of managers and some of us are born as people who will pay our dues and don't want to do much more than that. And that's fine too. And I really always believed that maybe I had another way to look at things, but that a number of really good people who were passionate about the profession, getting in a room and sharing and being honest with each other would lead to us elevating the profession or getting to a place we weren't at, whatever that was. And we in New York had major, major problems. When I was president-elect, I believe, they decided after we were prescribing for a year, the medical society decided they put up a bill that we would no longer prescribe. And by the way, that can happen tomorrow in almost any state. And I said, this is not going to happen. And I really learned, again, how to lead, how to put things together. And I was president-elect, and Charlie Huntington, bless his soul, was president. And Paul Lombardo followed me. So we had some really great leaders in New York, and all of us went on to be AAPA presidents. But we didn't know that then, and we really just said, we're not going to allow this. And we beat the medical society. And then a year later, they owned the only malpractice carrier in the state. And they issued a ruling, and the ruling was the physician had to be in the room while the PA practiced, right? So here we are again. You know, we just finished. We didn't have any money. Actually, the law firm at Montefiore Hospital represented us pro bono, which was the greatest thing ever because they were great lawyers. And we had like 12 lawyers. And a couple of them were, we became friendly. I became friendly with. And so we called them up again and said, here's what they're doing. And they said, we won't let them do that. And I said, okay, cool. We went to dinner with them and they always paid the bill. They were wonderful. And we later on, I hope Montefiore is not listening to this, by the way, later on, we brought patients up to Albany to testify and we beat them again. So, you know, leadership, I mean, what drew me to leadership is that I found it amazingly exhilarating. I believed in the profession so passionately, and Randy, you can stand up for that. And I really knew that I had something to give. Now, it might have been out of left field. It might not have been. It might have been 2 years earlier than everybody else thought of it. It might not have been. It might have been crazy, and it might not have been. But I knew I wanted to be in the room, like Hamilton. I wanted to be in the room when it happened. And that's really what it was about. And I knew I could contribute. and I wanted to contribute. There was something, and it's still, I can't walk away yet. I'm still involved. I'm still talking to people. I'm still talking to Jenna Roscoe. I'm still talking, you know, and it's, and I want to walk away sometimes and I can't. So whatever brought me there hasn't left me yet. And, you know, that's, I guess, my leadership story.
Well, that's great. And we don't want you to walk away, by the way.
Well, thank you.
So, Dave, in 1983, you made a drastic change in your work by moving into the medical publishing side of medicine. I was fortunate enough at the very beginning to witness that, and actually down the road have an opportunity to be on the editorial board of Clinician Reviews. But talk to us about that and where it led you all those years in medical publishing.
Okay, well, I'll tell you the little story that goes into that. So first of all, my wife, this has everything and nothing to do with it. My wife made me do like a personal growth workshop. And I was like, I don't need this stuff. It was called Actualizations. It was based on Maslow and hierarchy of needs and all that. And it was very experiential. And I did the workshop and I was working clinically and I really broke some really big, I was working for a place called HIP, Health Insurance Plan, and a lot of really good New York PAs were working for this place. And it had about 25 different centers all over New York City, my nose is itching, and Long Island. And so we were all friends, and we Frank Rodino and Jennifer Moore, names you know, and we mm-hmm. So we all went out together all the time. And the summer that I decided I wasn't going to work for them anymore, I averaged 51 people a day. And this was everything from I need a note because I was drunk to, and we were really autonomous. New York had great laws. My supervising physician and I only met each other when we needed each other. And he was a pulmonologist internist. And I knew derm and I knew trauma and I could read an x-ray of, you know, a wrist, and he had no idea. He was a pulmonologist. And so he could do congestive heart failure and those things better than I. And after the 51 people, which he had no say in at all, he was an employee like I was, I walked up and said, listen, I can't do this anymore. And Carol Murphy, who's, bless her, she's still Frank Rodino's wife. They're still married and they're in New Jersey. And she was a PA, graduated Yale, and she was the editor of Physician Assistant Journal, which was the official journal of the AAPA. And she had previously worked for HIP. So I called Frank first and he said, speak to Carol. You wrote like commentaries and editorials. Maybe there's something you can do at the journal. So I called her up and she said, leave HIP, come work for me. We'll find something for you to do. And I listened to her. I listened to all the women in my life. I listened to her. I left HIP, went, and the second day of work, I went out on a sales call. And I didn't know what a sales call was, but I went with these two guys who were professional salespeople of journals. And I went to a product manager's office, and he said, PAs don't really prescribe. It was the Inderal product manager, by the way. And I prescribed like tons of Inderal in my life. And he said, no, the doctor tells him what to write. And he didn't know as a PA. I was sitting in the back. Well, there were two guys in front of me and then me behind them. And at the end, I said, I'll never be able to do anything in this company. I have to be me. Randy knows that. And so I said, with all due respect, sir, may I write you a prescription? There's no physician in this room. I probably said doctor. And let's see what happens. If you take it to a pharmacy and fill it, put an ad in our journal. And if not, don't. And I said, by the way, I can give you four or five indications that are not, you know, the product's not indicated for, that I wrote your product for. I can tell you all the side effects. You know, let's talk about it. And he's like, I gave him the prescription and he rips it up in front of me. And he said, you know what? I believe you. So now you have a 4-page ad, every issue in Physician Assistant Journal, which was, again, the official journal. I was really proud. And my publishing career went like just right up. And within 2 years, I was publisher of the journal. And the other person who was publisher got transferred and she left after a while. It was nice. She was a good friend. And and not the editor, not Carol Murphy or whatever, but we had a great time. I was there for like 8.5 years. One of my classmates came down and worked with me, and I really learned business, budgeting. And the publisher, by the way, is in charge of the editorial and almost everything that goes on. Even negotiates, although I didn't, because we had someone else, but negotiates with the printer about, you know, how much printing costs are and paper costs and all this, really knows everything about it. And I really learned all that. And I realized I loved the business world now. And I loved meshing my PA passion into a journal for PAs. So it all worked really well. And then that came to an end, very much the same way working for Flatbush Medical Group came to an end. The people who bought, a new company bought Physician Assistant Journal, and without saying anything really specific, they were not nice people. And so after a while, I decided I was going to leave, and they didn't want to do something that I thought morally and ethically they needed and should have done. And so I turned around and spoke to the editor and the art director and all that. And we left, and I took the person from my class and someone else who worked there, and we started Clinician Reviews. And one of the things I learned from that, and what I'd love the class to know, is that business was the exact opposite of the way business treated people, their best people, was the exact opposite, except for this one company. But I mean, the company that I worked for the 8.75 years was wonderful. And I needed some things. I'm not going to go into it, but when you're valuable to a business in the business world, what they want to do is give you some golden handcuffs. They want you to stay there and keep producing money, keep bringing in income, keep doing what you do well. In medicine, what I learned and what I knew a little bit, but HIP was a different thing. It was like Kaiser's prepaid. But I learned from my friends was when they were excellent at what they did, when they wanted to learn more, when they said, let me open up another clinic on the other side of town, and maybe I could be a partner, or maybe I could have profit sharing, they were told no. And when they said, I want to learn more, it was called scope creep. And when they said, I want to be more involved, it was called, no, you're intruding on my personal space. Leave me alone. You're only an assistant kind of thing. And it was really interesting. And I've said for years, if we could take the culture of a well-run business and transfer it into medicine and treat our own people, ourselves and the people that work for us, or are over us or under us, and I don't mean over and under, but you know what I mean, people who just different positions, in the same way that we would want to be treated and acknowledged and rewarded, I think we could solve half the problems in medicine. And in the business world, that's what they do. They don't let you leave. They want you to stay forever. And so, you know, we made everybody who was good, and that's why we had 8 journals. We asked for everybody to come with their ideas. And if they came with our ideas and they were good ideas, we said, we will fund your entire idea and we will make you a partner. Now, we'll start a new corporation. So you have nothing to do with our corporation. We'll start basically a new business around your idea and your things. But I wish someone would have done that for me and you and all of us when we were at the zenith or the apex of our clinical years. We might not have left, or we might have just had a totally different future. And so it was very interesting. And business was, again, very rewarding, but I stayed connected to the profession all throughout because I was doing journals for the profession. So I, you know, the nice part, interesting part was I met some very famous physicians. We did neurology reviews, we did pulmonary reviews, we did a women's health. And we brought over the British Medical Journal, and we were the only people ever in the history of the BMJ for them to license it to someone else. And so that was really, really interesting. And that's probably how I got to write the first article in the BMJ on PAs. But it, you know, it's all part of business, and they loved it. And they were very intrigued. They were more intrigued about my partner and I being PAs. And they said, your name's horrible, when we met with the BMJ. And every time we told them, three times when we met with the BMJ, it's just an interesting historical thing. We met with their board, and they were all Sir William and Sir, and they first name, Sir David and Sir this and Sir Randy and Sir Bert and Sir, no women. And they kept on saying, so what do you do again as a PA in America? And my friend Tom was, my partner, was a neurosurgical PA at Tufts for 10 years. So he told them what he did, and they were like, that's impossible. You're a physician. And then I told them what I did in primary care, and they said, and you're a GP. And they just said, if you were in our country, and then they hated the name, and they said, if we ever get PAs, they're going to be called associate. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
It is. And this is probably a good time to sort of, I don't want to lose the opportunity of talking about some professional issues. You know,
sure.
you of all people know what happened back in 2017 at the House of Delegates in Las Vegas, when the profession approved what we called optimum team performance. Before that, we were calling it full practice. Yeah. Full practice authority, you know, so, you know, tell us your thoughts about OTP. And I want to get into a couple other things before we end up today, but
okay.
But talk to me about OTP and your thoughts about the significant change in many areas of PA practice.
Well, I think OTP is wonderful. Well, first of all, we have to back up. And I wrote a commentary, which you should send around, or I'll send back to you if you don't have it, that we need to form a real full profession. Professions in America, and we're the only one that doesn't do this, by the way, they self-regulate, they self-discipline, they plan their own future. And like I said, OTP, to those of us that were really involved in it, and planning and going to the House of Delegates, but I was on the board. And I think, I don't think I was president-elect yet. I think that was the next year. But it was more, actually it was 2 years later, but I was pushing like crazy for it. But it was more to many of us about starting the journey to forming a real profession that self-regulates and self disciplines and is not an appendage of another profession that A, looks at us as competition. B, most medical boards do not have to go to PA school, so they don't understand our education. C, they're brought up in a culture, physicians are, where they're taught that you can't learn medicine unless you go to medical school. And most physicians would agree with that comment. I'm not going out on a limb here. And so we knew what we were facing, and it wasn't about, let's just go get full practice because the NPs were doing it. What happened was the last year, it started to dovetail that state leadership and national leadership started to hear comments back from their membership that NPs in states that passed full practice were taking their jobs. So that was added pressure, certainly on PA officials, but that really wasn't the reason that we saw the need for OTP. And I think today, OTP is confusing. Most people have no understanding of it. The schools aren't teaching it, and if they are, many aren't teaching it correctly. Nobody knows, and I can tell you this now because I'm teaching an advocacy course and I've been teaching for years now, and I ask my students, what does at the practice level mean? Nobody can answer the question, and no one can answer it correctly in relation to OTP. And I think we have to really almost pivot the paradigm and look at it as PA modernization. That we've been using legislation that all of us in every state, except Mississippi and New Jersey, seriously, that was written in the mid 70s. And that legislation was written when we were an experiment. And nobody knew how good we would be. And so what did we need? We needed supervision. We needed charts countersigned, even though there was absolutely no studies or no research to support that that worked in any way. But we needed it. And we wound up, most of us, getting it 2 weeks after we wrote the prescription anyway. And we needed ratios. And again, nobody knew if that worked or not, but it sounded right. And they didn't know what to do with us. So people put legislation together. And then 40 and 50 years later, that legislation was no longer working correctly. And that's really what OTP was about. It was establishing a PA board. It was saying, we don't need supervision. Tell me why an optometrist who sees pathology they can't treat all day, they must see pterygiums, they must see retinal detachments, they must see all kinds of stuff. Tell me why a psychologist who can't prescribe at all in most states, maybe one state, okay, has to refer anyone who needs an antidepressant and anti-anxiety, forget about schizophrenia and the biggies. They all have to refer, but they don't have a physician in their law. Why an audiologist doesn't have an ENT in their law? Why, you know, and I can go on and on and on. Why they don't, because they've modernized their profession and we were still in the 1970s. And some states were in the 1940s, it seemed like. And it was like, okay, it's time. We need to do this. We need to do this to compete in the future. But we also passed the experiment test. We're good. We're damn good. I'm sorry, but we are. And we didn't tell anyone because we, part of our culture was living in, don't tell anyone, keep your head down, be a good girl, be a good boy. And I'm saying that purposely so you don't make trouble. And you know what? There's, as a famous congressman said, there's good trouble sometimes. And we never made it. And it was time, because it was catching up with us, to say we're good enough. And you know, our other mistake, and people still, we need to teach our students. We need to be our own profession. We are not physicians, nor do we have to be as good as physicians. I don't mean in the studies, our outcomes should be very good. But I mean, we don't have to say we're 95 or 105 or 125 or 85. That's meaningless. What we have to say is what we do in medical care, we do really well. We are excellent at. And what we don't do, we will refer to someone who is excellent at what we don't do well. And that should be our entire story. We need to modernize and we need to be able to go out and reach the people. We will lower costs. We will increase access. And you know what? There's the other C word that nobody talks about, but legislators are very much into it, the Federal Trade Commission's into it, is competition. And in medicine, competition's another word we've never uttered, yet we should at times say medicine needs competition. It needs to look at innovative ways to deliver care. And we don't speak of that either. Not saying we should do it all the time, but at certain times, with legislators maybe. My bottom line is, we need to plan our own future. It's very hard to do that with another profession with its thumb on your back all the time, because you walk around worried, scared. You don't want to get everybody angry. And I think we need to have people in charge of us legislatively who know us, who know the way we practice, who know who we are, who've been through our schooling. Every other profession has that. We deserve just the same thing that every other profession has. And that should be our story. And I think When my only other critique of OTP is I think in some states they're looking at, let's do it piece by piece by piece. Let's go for collaboration and let's go for this. And I think we're finding out it's confusing to legislators. Well, this year you want collaboration and next year you don't need it anymore? We should just, in this case, model much of what the NPs have done. I think our training's much better. It's broader. It's medical. It's different in a way. I mean, they're trained vertically. We're trained horizontally. Forgetting all of that, tell people what you are and what you can do. And don't change the story every year. You know, in the 8 years that I've been involved, I mean, at the AAPA, I think we've had, you know, until we passed OTP, we had four different stories. And even with our title, you know, we're assistants are great. Now it's just say PA for 3 years. Then it's, well, now we're associates, but you're not allowed to tell anybody. And we go through these crazy things where we look like we're still not sure of ourselves all the time. And so one of my things that I'd like to leave us all to think about is, I think the NPs say, we want full practice, we're really good, we're excellent in what we do, whether we agree or disagree, and then they just keep going back until it passes. And I think that's a much better way than saying, well, we're going to chip off collaboration, and then we're going to chip off this, and then finally, maybe someday we'll get to, you know, in my state, it'll never work. But it'll never work if you don't ask for it. That's for sure. And, I think we need to ask for it. You don't get what you don't ask for. And so, you know, we have to be, we just, sometimes you have to stick your foot in the water. That's my take on OTP today. And we have a number of states going for it, by the way. Yep. So I'm very, very proud and I hope they get it.
Yeah, I like sticking your toe in the water. Sometimes we're sticking our toe in the electrical outlet, but
yes,
but yeah, really. You know, in a minute we're going to go on to the name change. But one of the things about OTP that I think was genius and should have started 15, 20 years ago, and that is PA specific regulatory boards. As you know, Arizona is one of the five that has its own regulatory board, where 50% of the board are PAs. All of the members are appointed by the governor, and it's been that way since we changed that, I think, 10 years ago. But I think, you know, unfortunately, it's an uphill battle in many states to try to get a PA-specific regulatory board. But I think if we did that, if we had started this 10 years ago, I think we would have more now, and I think it would be great, you know, for the legislation in that state.
Well, it's also, you know, again, talking about confusing, one of my personal thoughts is we need to put the title change into any other legislation we do. Because what we're finding out, again, what we're learning at the ground level is that it's very confusing for a legislator when they know nothing about us, to say, I'm a doctor's assistant, because that's what they hear, but I want to be independent now. And they hear alone, and they don't get the story. And the story is nobody's independent. The story is everybody's in a group and everybody consults. And the story is completely different, you know, than Marcus Welby and again, 1970 and being in a solo practice, and you need an assistant to help you. And even in 1975, I wasn't that. You know, I was, and I think most of us would never, here's a towel, doctor. Thank you, Dave. It wasn't that. It was never that. But they think it was that. And now they think, well, we're doing it because the MPs did it or something. And it has to be, the story has to be about modernization. So now we can, I'm ready. I'm ready for you, man.
Well, one more thing. You know, I think I told you last month I was invited to speak to a group of 10 osteopathic healthcare policy fellows on campus. And I was worried about it because, you know, here we had, actually there were 9 osteopathic physicians and one dietitian who was doing a fellowship, and they want to know where's the PA profession going. And I went there, feeling, I don't want to get in this big argument, but I have to tell you, it was 2 hours of wonderful conversation, asking wonderful questions, very respectful both directions. At the end of the day, they said, we get it where you're coming from, and do you get where we're coming from? And I thought, if you don't have the conversation, this will never happen, So, and so we keep having to have that conversation whenever and wherever we can. And on to the title change, when I brought up the issue of changing it to physician associate, they just shrugged their shoulders and said, okay.
Right.
Yeah. I, the questions I get all the time about, the old thing, can I call myself a physician associate now? Well, no, the AAPA says you can't. You got to wait for the state legislation. I know you and I talked about that earlier. So your thoughts about that?
Well, the title change is interesting. A, we needed it. B, I personally think when any of us call ourselves someone's assistant, we're lying to them, because I never did that. Now, if you do that, you're not lying to them, but I never did it. And again, you can be too. We've always lived in a. It's a debatable world, but we have too much fear in our profession, and we always were worried about something. Someone's going to come and report us, get us this, that, and we weren't assistants. And I felt like I was lying because I had my own panel of patients. I had like 2,500 patients at hip. I was the first PA to have my own panel, or one of the first two or three for sure, because we didn't keep up daily with each other, but. And I had patients, and in the Air Force, I had patients, and they were my patients. They were clearly my patients. So I wasn't assisting anybody. Our new title is fine. I like the other one better, actually. I didn't want physician in our name because I didn't want them to use the excuse that we were confusing patients. And I liked practitioner because I thought there's a level of medicine. Again, I don't want to be a physician. I don't want them to say, well, you put physician in there, which they're saying now, by the way. And it's like, no, we've had physician in there for 55 years. It's associate that we put in there. And that was my birth title when I graduated. And in the 70s, it was a lot of our birth title. I would venture to say most PA programs were health associate or something associate or physician associate in the 70s. So, I like it. I think we could have devised some better ways to launch it. We're launching it now, but you're not allowed to say it. Again, makes not a lot of sense to me, but we'll go along with it a little longer. I think many PAs at the ground level, at the practice level, which we should still talk about somehow, but they're using associate. And I don't think the medical boards are going to come after us. They're just real fast. Let me give you the reasons why. Number one, a physician never uses the title that they were given, ever uses the title they were given. Why isn't the medical board going after them? They're physicians, not doctors. I've never heard a physician walk in and say, hi, I'm Physician Smith, and I'm here to take care of you today. How can I help you? Never. Maybe it's me, but I hear I'm Dr. Smith, or I'm Cardiologist Smith, or I'm, Dr. Smith, the cardiologist. But I've never heard Physician Smith. Yet that's their title. Nobody comes down on them. Number two, there are five in my state using the title physician who are not physicians. The medical board isn't coming down on them. And then there was a third one, which I'm forgetting. But at the end of the day, there's too many holes in this where I think if we all just said we're a physician associate, And that's a physician assistant. It's just another name for it. And not trying to be confuse people or be a physician, but that's our name. Our national association changed the name. And, you know, that I don't think if we all did it, they certainly wouldn't censure all of us. And again, like you said, it's, I don't know, physician associate isn't even a protected title. So we're not trying to be something that we're not. That's legislatively, we can't say we can, but it's still too confusing a little bit. But we need to think about it just as we need to think and learn from our OTP, both things that we do well, and I guess best practices is what I'm thinking of on all sides. But I think the people who were against title change are using, let's not talk about it until it passes in all the states, as an excuse not to change or at least support it. And there's a couple of big groups that we can talk about, which we won't right now, but they're not supporting it because, again, there's, I don't even know why, because they shouldn't be fearful. And Connecticut, by the way, was the first state, and they changed their state title to Connecticut Academy of Physician Associates. So CONAPA is now, and I think some more will be doing it soon, but they don't want to hurt their OTP chances. And I think you just throw it in together, and because they're not going to be any more angry if you have OTP or PA modernization legislation and the new title is in there than if not. And again, I've been talking to a number of people, state presidents or legislative chairs, and they've been saying that the hardest thing to do still is to get a legislator to shift their paradigm, because you're calling yourself an assistant, but you're saying, I don't want to assist anymore. And they're saying, well, but you're an assistant. And you're saying, no, I'm not. I never did that. And you're saying, well, if you never did it, why did you call yourself that for 50 years? and they don't get it either. So there's some stuff we have to clean up. So that's I love the title. I love that we changed it. I don't feel like I'm lying. And if you really don't like it or don't, you know, you're uneasy, just say PA at this point. And it's still better.
Yeah, let's pile one more thing on there before we try to land this airplane. Let's talk about the relatively new post-professional doctorate for PAs. You know, is it good for the profession? What's your take? First of all, is it good for the profession, this new post-professional doctorate? And then a side issue, you know, what's your take on the discussion now about the entry-level doctorate degree in PA education? And as you know, PAEA is having another doctoral summit next month on this issue down in Charlotte. So post-professional doctorate and entry level.
Okay. Post-professional, I love it, obviously. I think, again, 10 years too late. We should have started a long time ago, but we started when we started. Like everything else in life, the eureka moment came at the eureka moment. So it came when it came. I believe that the postgraduate doctoral programs will have 10 more in 3 years. We'll have a lot more. Some of them will be clinical, some will be a mix, some will be more non-clinical, administrative or teaching or leadership or an amalgam of all three in a way. I think entry level, someone's going to do it. And when they do it, they're going to get 10 times more people applying to their program than most other PA programs have. Even if it's 3 or 4 months longer, when you look at the number of graduate credit hours we get compared to most other, again, audiology and you know, speech pathology and whatever, and then, you know, all there's so many, the OTs and the PTs. I mean, I never met a PT, I'm not putting down PT profession, in the ER at 3 in the morning when I was on rotations. And I don't know if they're still doing it, but our rotations were 80 hours a week, 70 hours a week. We were in school. We were at the hospital all the time. You know, I didn't meet an occupational therapist there. I didn't meet, you know, even a pharmacist, for the most part, wasn't standing in the ER when I was suturing someone up. Yes, they have, you know, really pharmacists who work in the hospital as a consultant pharmacist, as doctoral trained. But there's something gained when you say you're doctorally prepared. The other thing is, how long will it take before some profession puts up a law and says, I don't need to listen to PA orders anymore. They're trained at a master's level. We're trained at a doctoral level. Sorry. You know, NPs will be trained at a doctoral level sooner or later. I mean, it's certainly in their planning, professional planning. It was supposed to be 2015, 2020, 2025 now. It's not going to happen for a while because many reasons, same reasons that our profession probably would have. Faculty isn't ready. There's a number of things. But at the end of the day, and they don't do the hours we do. They do 500, 700 hours. We do 2,000, 2,500 hours or something. So it's a completely different thing. But they would say they have their nursing school hours. But still, at the end of the day, I think it'll happen on an entry level. You know, you just go right into a program. You do 32 months or 30 months or 31 months, and you'll get it. Also, there will be many, many, many programs. We now have 170,000 PAs. I mean, the number from the NCCPA that was researched done months ago was 159,000, and I'm sure 1,000 more have graduated. So we're about like 160 certified. And then another 10,000 that dropped their C because they're in New York or California or many of the states where you don't need your C. It's about 170,000 people. They're going to have to go to some kind of program, some of them, and they're going to be grandfathered in. I mean, nobody wants to exclude anybody. I still have friends who have associate degrees, but the younger people are going to look towards the doctorate. I don't know that we should make it a terminal degree at this point, but we should certainly be open to it. And, you know, one of the things I wrote a letter to the editor about Cawley's commentary, but people are saying even about minorities. If you're a Black young man or woman or any minority and you have a 3.8 index, because that's basically what it takes to get into PA school today or many PA programs, and you've done your pre-med work, you can probably get into podiatry school, chiropractic school, PT school, OT school, psychology school, you know, just name all the other doctorates and you can get into most of those programs. In fact, I was speaking to a couple of people and they said they could have gotten in with a scholarship, with some money. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, if I came from Brooklyn, I came from a minority area, my parents weren't happy that I was going to be called somebody's assistant, seriously. And if we knew better, and if all those professions were bachelor degree professions or less when I was in PA school and you were in PA school, but if they were doctorate, and I happened to fall in love with the PA profession, so I don't think I would have went anywhere, but if I could be a doctor and go home to my parents and say, I'm rising the entire family, I'm going to be the first doctor ever produced by our family, I'm going to have an office, I'm in fact, I'm going to gather with three or four of my classmates, and we're going to open up a small group. And, you know, my own profession disciplines me and regulates me. And I, you know, I don't even know the craziness of the PA profession in that way. And I can really specialize. And you know, I was speaking to a Black man who was a young man who was a forensic psychologist. And I said, why didn't you become a PA? And he said, the word assistant. And I didn't know what you did. And no one ever told me to do that. Plus, being a doctor really meant something to my parents. And it cost a lot of money. And he said, since I've met some PAs, I think you guys are great. But if I'm going to spend that much money, I want to be a doctor. So there's two sides to this story. I think we'd attract a lot more people, actually, who are not attracted to us now because
of the title.
They don't see the merit. They don't know us well enough. And guidance counselors don't know us well enough. And, you know, it even the Black physicians weren't telling people generally to go become PAs. They were basically saying, we want physicians. And so it's complicated, but I think that issue needs to be looked at a little more. And people use it all the time. It was used in Cawley's commentary. I think it'll increase reimbursement. People tend not to reimburse master's level clinicians of any kind at the same level that they do doctorate level. You know, I don't see us as the only profession really in our country that can diagnose, treat, and prescribe. We are the only profession that, number one, is tethered to another profession, but number two, is not at the doctoral level. And maybe it'll make it easier to get full practice or PA modernization when people see you as a doctorally prepared clinician. I don't know. But I would bet that it probably will. Can't hurt.
No. So I'm going to wrap up our class today, Dave, and hopefully there'll be some questions after. But my last question to you is, what would be your advice to our DMSE students and our graduates about the future of the PA profession?
I wrote some things down. So in no order, but these two first things are definitely, you know, in primary order. Number one is, don't be stupid, but be bold. When we can, let's be bolder than we've been in the past. Like I'm giving the profession to you, and I'm telling you what I've learned. Number two is, question everything. There's no reason not to, especially you're going to be trained at the doctoral level. Your critical thinking skills are wonderful. I didn't have those when I got out of PA school. And I listened to what everybody said. And so do many of us. Question everything. Ask your leadership when they run what their vision is. Ask them what Randy just asked me. What is the future of the PA profession look like to them? I think you'll filter out some leaders that you don't want leading you. Again, be pro things that advance us. Let go of some of that angst or that fear that we carry with us, and we all do. Let's work on education. I think we need to meet one of the things we've done really poorly is educate other professionals. I'll give you an example. The AAPA has liaisons with almost every medical specialty, but none with the 3.2 or whatever that number is, I didn't look it up, million RNs in America. PAs work with RNs every day. We don't have a liaison with RNs. They could help us with OTP if they understood where we were coming from. We don't even talk to them. We don't talk to them as an organization. How about pharmacists? We don't talk to them as an organization. You know, so we need to start reaching out to people. We don't have a liaison, a formal liaison, although we do talk to them a lot with NPs. We don't want them posing our legislation when we put it up. Let's start to get to know the other members of the healthcare team. And we don't. And I'm telling you, we don't. We need to learn how to advocate better. And I think we need to teach it in our regular PA programs. We need to start to teach advocacy. We need to start to teach things like PA modernization and what at the practice level means. We need to start, and your students are going to have to do this. Look at taking away supervision and collaboration doesn't mean that it's the Wild West. It means we start to do at the practice level what every other profession does at the practice level. Residency is done at the practice level. There's no law that says you must do 4 years. They can make it a 3-year residency. They can make medical school 3 years. They have. That's all at the practice level. What it says is you have to go through an approved program just like we do. Our approved programs are many different months in length. But at the end of the day, when you graduate, you're a PA. Same thing. Then at the practice level, are we going to, you know, we'll get credentialed, we'll get insurance companies, we'll get all these people looking at us, deciding whether we're competent enough. But what if we want to keep going? What are we going to do? Fellowships? Are we going to do residencies? Are we going to do 1 year? Are we going to do 2 years? Where are we going to evolve at that practice level into? We're going to do them with NPs. We're going to do them not with NPs. Maybe we should do it together. I don't know, because they're going to have the same problem. They're going to have to show their competency to insurance companies and Medicare and other people. And then strategic planning, I think. What we don't do well also, we do a lot of things well, and I think lately we've been doing them better and better. But one of the things we don't do is look at the whole big picture and say, where do we fit in? What could we do better to fit in better? Even at large hospital systems, we need to get them involved. We need to say, we are one of the best things that ever happened to you, and tell them what we do really well and say, where can you fit us in? And now we're starting to get PAs in hospital systems leadership, so they're going to advocate for us. But for years, we had nobody, you know, advocating at most hospitals for us, or very few people. I think we need a media strategy. It can't be PA Week and that's it. It has to be more than that. So there's one of the other leadership things I've learned is that there are, once we hit on what's best for us, there's a lot of different paths to get there. So we maybe have two or three different committees working on different versions of getting to the same place. And whoever does it first, whoever does it better, or whoever is smarter, they get there first. But that's really what I wrote. I think we have to be smarter. We have to be more nimble. We have to be less afraid and bold, and believe in our product more than I think some people do, and not worry so much. We're good. We can do it. I'm not worried about that.
That's great. I'm going to hopefully see if anybody has any questions for Dave. And while you're thinking, let me start. You know, Dave, I know you're retired, that R word, but you're still busier than anybody I know. What do you do for fun?
Playing bocce with my wife and also on a bocce team. And I'm so good that my community picked me to represent them now. We're going to have, like, against other communities, like an invitational tournament. So I'm doing that. I'm now, don't think less of me, but I actually am an expert in UAPs or UFOs, and read hundreds of books, not hundreds, but like 30 or 40 books, watched some stuff. I've yet to go to the MUFON, which is like a really bona fide, serious national organization conference, but I'd like to. And I think we're probably a year away from the government releasing more information. So I'm fascinated by that. Studied a lot about other religions and my own religion. Although I believe in God, my God's much more like the Force than it is an old guy on a cloud telling me that I've sinned or not sinned. My religion doesn't really have sin. It's just like you're good or bad, you know, kind of thing. And it goes away. So it's cool. But I like my religion, and I like how humans relate to both a higher power and stuff they don't understand. It fascinates me. I'm really into politics. I'm in our current events club, and I used to run a lot of the meetings because it was like running a board meeting, and I could like be angry to people and like, you're out of order kind of stuff. And since COVID, we stopped those, but I like those. And what else? Oh, and my New York Mets. So my wife and I both love the Mets. And once baseball season starts, so we get spring training down here. And then once baseball season starts, we basically almost watch every game. And so we take a glass of wine or two. And then after, you know, after dinner, we have our wine. And then the game starts. And then we watch a game for a while. And then we go into the bedroom and watch a game. And we have MLB.com, so we can watch every Met game in Florida. And we love it. So there's a lot going on. We just got a new rescue dog, so our dog's great. And teaching it. It never met people. It was from Puerto Rico, and then it was brought here as a puppy, and it stayed in the kennel for a year. I don't know why. It's gorgeous, a little black like lab mix. So it looks like a black lab, and it's beautiful. And it never had human contact. So of course, we have to take him because we said we can fix him, and we are slowly actually getting him to love people and interact and hug us and, you know, I mean, cuddle up with us. And so I'm loving it all. I'm loving it all.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. I know we're running out of time. Any questions from anybody? If you have a question, just unmute yourself. And
I'd love to answer them or try to or attempt to.
Well, maybe not. And okay. That's fine. That's fine. I really appreciate your time today, Dave, you know, participating in our masterclass. And for all the rest of you and for those who get an opportunity to watch this later, you know, thanks for joining us. So please
you're welcome.
Thanks, Dave, so much.
And I just hope what I wanted to do today and is just get, doggy. Is just get people to think. You know, I just think, keep asking why and keep thinking. And I know you guys have a great program. I'm sure they're learning that from other people too, but it's something I picked up along the way that I really wanted to say. So thanks everybody. It's been wonderful, and it's been wonderful meeting some new friends, and thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. Well, for everybody, please mark on your calendar our next masterclass. It's going to be on March 6th. It's going to be with Greg Thomas. Dave, you know Greg, who just recently retired from the NCCPA as Director of PA Relations and has a long history of advocacy for the profession, both within the NCCPA, the AAPA, and PAEA. So we hope to see you all there. And again, Dave, thanks for your evening, your time this evening. Give our best to your wife, and everybody have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thanks.